The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Now, before we get back to talking about fintech, I want to take a quick moment to tell you about eFinancialCareers.com, one of the supporters of the show. They're the world's leading career site for financial service professionals for over 15 years. eFinancialCareers.com partners with leading financial and fintech firms, so your resume is seen by all the top companies and recruiters in the U.S. and abroad. Now, as we all know, financial services is a very dynamic, ever-changing industry, and eFinancial Careers provides valuable resources from helpful career coaching to interview strategies and tools that keep you up to speed and well-informed with what's happening now in the industry and what it means for your career. Registration's free for financial professionals. Make sure you take advantage of all the resources they have to offer. So check them out, eFinancialCareers.com.
Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest-growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Welcome to Breaking Banks. I'm Brett King, your host. This episode's a little different. As you all know, the hosts of Provoke have intense, crazy travel and meeting schedules. I did 33 countries last year. JP's done 3, I think, this month. So we're always speaking at conferences around the globe most at weeks out of the year. So we had a special opportunity come up, and since our hosts were busy, we sent our talented producer, Rachel Morrissey, on this special assignment. Now, before we get to that, got a few conference announcements to get out of the way. I've just finished the Paris FinTech Forum in Paris. We had a great time. Laurent Nisri did a fantastic event there. I think it's the biggest FinTech Forum he's had. About 2,600 people at the event. It was a great couple of days here. But the other conference announcements happening coming up on Thursday, February 8, 2018. You can check me out presenting at the Click Financial Services Analytics Summit here in New York City. Well, there in New York City because I'm in Paris, and it'll be at the Convene Center, and it's free to Breaking Bank listeners, but space is limited. So go to click.com/FinServeSummit18 to register today. Jason Hendricks, a fellow Provoke host, will be at the American Bankers Association National Conference for Community Bankers. That's a mouthful. February 25th to 28th, 2018 at the Hilton Hawaiian Village Waikiki Beach Resort. We get the toughest gigs, I know. A leadership and management conference. This is designed for community bank CEOs, presidents, senior staff, and bank directors with a focus on success in a transformational environment. Hear from industry leaders and a few people like Jason who are escaping the winter chills down to Hawaii, up to Hawaii, across to Hawaii to do that. As they say, real combat pay assignment there, Jason. And in the news, we have a few interesting news items for you guys to check out. So Rabobank has set up a 60 million euro tech venture fund. This is not unusual for banks in Europe to do this. We've seen the Spanish banks, BBVA, Santander, Sberbank in Russia. This is good to see these guys participating in this. You probably heard the news that Moovin has signed a memorandum of understanding with Japan's SBI Group to launch a joint venture in Japan. So we're pretty excited about that. You can check out finextra.com for the press release and some more information on that. There's interesting news that the virtual assistant startup Finn.ai, that's F-I-N-N.ai, hired the ex-Twitter exec, Stephen Morse. So we're starting to see more of this. You know, we're starting to see Google's name pop up in hires and so forth. CBA, of course, Commonwealth Bank in Australia, announced the appointment of their new CEO and went to great pains to explain his digital expertise that went into the thing. In the news on the hacking front and cybersecurity, we had the ATM jackpotting scare that hit the US, and of course, a big cyber theft that I'm sure you guys have heard of as well. Robin Hood out of the US introduced free Bitcoin trading, which is pretty good. And Deutsche Bank joined the World Economic Forum Center to help shape robot future. But the one I thought was most interesting was Baidu. They sought to raise $2 billion for their finance unit. This is obviously follows on from the success of Alibaba, Alipay, and Tencent WeChat with their initiatives they're doing around finance in China today. So pretty big news. Okay, so about a year ago, you may recall I was in Kenya and I did a special episode on M-Pesa and the difference it's made to the Kenyan economy. Remember the incredible adoption rate of M-Pesa? We're talking about virtually all of the adult population has an M-Pesa account. We're talking about 40% of Kenya's GDP that goes through the M-Pesa network. And then we spoke to, of course, the central bank governor and talked about the foresight that the central bank had to encourage the promotion of financial inclusion through M-Pesa, which I thought was pretty exciting stuff. It was, I think, one of our best episodes last year, but this episode today is a bit of a companion to that episode. So the MasterCard Innovation Hub in Kenya, partnering with the Gates Foundation, have been working on furthering financial inclusion and using M-Pesa as a foundation or a launching pad for that. So they're creating new rails to continue to build credit and prosperity among Kenyans with lower incomes. And they've created two new products, MasterPass QR and KioNect. Now, both of these products are designed to help the smaller merchants in Kenya capitalize on digital payments. So I'm going to let Rachel take the episode from here, from down in Nairobi, Kenya.
Hello, Breaking Banks listeners. I am Rachel Morrissey. I'm the producer. Our show was invited to participate in a media tour of the MasterCard Innovation Lab's work in Nairobi, Kenya. And they have two projects they wanted people to know about. Today, we're going to talk about KioNect. Now, I was the only Provoke member that didn't have speeches that they just came back from or were going to. So I went to Nairobi in December, which is a great time to go because I live in Brooklyn. And Brooklyn in December is cold. And I land in Nairobi and the sun is shining and it is a balmy 70 degrees. Nairobi is exactly like what I expected. It is very cosmopolitan, it has terrible traffic, and it was very green there. And when I asked the hotel driver about it, he said that as Nairobi developed, they actually lost a lot of trees, and this led to a lot of drought and problems with pollution. And the president at the time encouraged everyone to plant 5 trees for every one that they pulled up. I did not fact check this, but the result is that Nairobi has trees everywhere, on every roadside, every corner, and in most of the medians. There are trees growing. And the very informed driver said that the trees bring rain and there aren't droughts there anymore. So that was what Nairobi felt like. Very lovely in December. And as I said before, I was in Nairobi as part of a media tour of the MasterCard Innovation Lab. Now, the Innovation Lab plays a few roles inside MasterCard.
Well, there's 4 things that we really try to do within the lab's organization. The first is we try to drive a culture of innovation within the entire MasterCard. So that's a big job. MasterCard's a big organization and the lab's organization is not.
That was Michael Elliott. He is the Vice President of Innovation Management and the Director of the labs in Singapore, in Nairobi, and in several smaller labs around the globe.
The lab here in Nairobi and the work that you guys are going to see over the next, some of the work that you're going to see over the next 2 days comes out of our Nairobi lab. Founded in late 2014, supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. They gave us about $19 million to support the lab. And what the lab here is trying to do is really drive financial inclusion, try to find underserved people, about 100 million of them, initially in Africa, but we're starting to look at India now as well, 100 million individuals and get them onto formal financial services by 2020. That's kind of the big goal that we keep in mind for the lab here in Nairobi. How do we do that? Why do we do that? Well, maybe the why. Why are we focused on financial inclusion at all, right? There's 2 billion adults today that are unbanked. Disproportionate number of those are women and youth. Right? These are people that don't have access to some of the services that you and I take for granted. Services like saving for a rainy day, services like getting access to credit at a reasonable rate, or services like getting insurance to protect us against unforeseen events. They don't have access to these today. And if we can give them access, we see two things, right? We see a personal impact, an individual impact for that person, but we also see a growing of the economy when you do that. And that's actually good for our business as well.
So before we continue to talk about the lab and the work it is doing in Kenya, I wanted to take a step back. The Gates Foundation has a mission to help provide financial services for the poor, particularly in underdeveloped countries. They work with governments and nonprofits as well, but they really focus on work with for-profit private sector because a for-profit model is more likely to be self-sustaining. Basically, they're trying to encourage business that does well by doing good. So the lab's work is very integrated with that goal. And in that spirit, the second thing they do is forecast what will be happening in the future. The third is an education outreach and providing white papers and plans broadly. They publish it openly. And finally...
We actually build stuff. Great and disrupt. We actually build stuff. So the lab here in Nairobi, there's 20 of us in that lab. The majority of them are developers. So these are engineers. Every day they're getting up and they're building something, right? We've got products in agriculture, which I'll talk about, agriculture, education, micro-retail. But we build these products and we get them out into the field as quickly as we can. We prototype them, we pilot them. Those that are showing promise, we incubate, and then we try to scale those that are really making an impact.
Now, Kenya is a very popular testing ground, partially because of M-Pesa. Now, we did a show on M-Pesa last February. I always encourage everyone to listen to it. But basically, M-Pesa is a widely adopted digital payment system. And that means services and further development can be built on top of it. And Kenya has a lot of other attractions for being this kind of center for development. First, the government is very friendly. Africa is poised to be a $3 trillion economy by 2030. Kenya has been the economic powerhouse of East Africa, and it had a goal of being a developed economy by 2030. And part of the reason that seemed possible is M-Pesa. 50% of the country's GDP passes through mobile money transfers, mostly on Safaricom's M-Pesa. The single biggest obstacle to Kenya being considered a developed economy is its reliance on cash. I know, that doesn't make sense. I just said 50% was on M-Pesa and digital, and now I'm saying it's reliant on cash. Well, despite M-Pesa, cash remains the currency for 95% of transactions. Cash has all kinds of problems. It has security risks. It attracts illicit activity like drug running and poaching, which are both problems in Kenya. And it has a high cost of management. And because of the high reliance on cash, over 60% of Kenya's economy is part of the dark economy, or economic activity with no record. Dark doesn't necessarily imply criminal, just that we don't really have a good record of what's happened. And just so you get a comparison, about 7% of the U.S. economy is dark. Yeah, 7% versus over 60%. That lack of transparency makes it difficult for the government to tax fairly or to make a comprehensive economic policy. With these P2P transactions, the receiver cashes out. So there's a lot of cash used at what they call MSMEs, micro, small to medium enterprises. Now, an MSME is a business that operates on a very low transaction volume, about $20 a day. And there are over 1 million MSMEs in East Africa. There are 100,000 in Kenya. They are the economic backbones to their communities. MSMEs create around 80% of the region's employment, and they fuel the demand for goods and services. There is a growing demand because there's also a youth boom, and there are real challenges to making a living in agriculture. Now, again, I spoke to Michael Elliott about why that was such a problem.
And we have this enormous youth population that's coming up, and we don't have formal jobs for them, right? And many of them are moving out of the agriculture sector as well, which is a problem. They're coming out of the land and moving into the cities. And we need to find things for them to do and productive ways for them to be part of the economy.
So why are they leaving the agriculture jobs? Are they not paying? Are they boring? Or
it's a really interesting question. I don't think anyone has the answer to it. I mean, what we tend to see is that for so long, agriculture in Africa, smallholder agriculture in Africa, has been subsistence agriculture. You grow what you eat, but it's not really a way to grow more, and you're not turning it into a business. There's not a lot of potential, really, for growth. At least that's how they used to see it. The reality is actually different. The reality is, if you run your farm like a business, you can make more of it. If you're investing in inputs and if you're using the latest agricultural techniques. But the challenge we need to get that message across to the youth. In the meantime, what we're seeing is the youth are saying, looking at their parents and saying, this is not the future I want. I want more. And they think the city brings them more. And so you're seeing this big move to the city. And then you see kind of the hustlers here who are doing it by any way they can. And hustler in Kenya is not, it doesn't have a negative connotation like we sometimes have in the U.S.
No, New York doesn't have a negative connotation of hustler. I mean, if New Yorkers didn't hustle, they'd get run over.
And that's exactly how it is in Kenya. That's the reality.
So after I spoke to Michael, I got a chance to speak to Dennis Gikunda, who leads the innovation efforts at the lab. We were on a trip to Kawangware, which, for the lack of a better term, is a slum. But really, it's an undeveloped urban or exurban area. It's a bit wild, but don't get the wrong impression from the word slum.
Yeah, my name is Dennis Gikunda. So my job is leading our innovation management efforts at the lab. So as a lab, that means we are constantly looking at new potential areas where we can have impact. The impact for us is connecting underserved communities to financial services. So my team spends a lot of time doing research, essentially, and we try sort of build out hypotheses or potential problems we can solve. And then I work very closely with our design user experience design team to conjure up concepts that can solve those problems. So I love my job. It's a really, really cool job. It's hard because you get to see a lot of challenges that people face, but there's always a motivation to see how technology can be used to solve those problems. That's what gets me up in the morning.
Okay. Every 5 feet or so, we saw an M-Pesa stand,
yes.
Right? And M-Pesa has been like the story out of Kenya, and it's this brilliant way to do P2P. And we've even seen it employed in some shops. It seems like the problem that you're focusing on here is basically a small business solution. So what was it about a small business solution as opposed to, you know, families or other individual solutions? Like, why were you focusing on that problem?
Like I said, when we're typically starting, we're thinking of people who do not have access to financial services. And when you start talking to them, you realize actually the financial services are one small part. They're a tool. Right, to get somewhere. They're just trying to improve their lives, trying to build resilience. And so we're often thinking about the context in which they are. So a lot of the times that's rural, that's peri-urban. So it's urban, but it's kind of, you know,
undeveloped
urban and very dense, very low infrastructure, resource constrained. This is where those people are. So the next thing you take stock of is there's a lot of people in these areas. So you can look at the research. It's 70 to 80% rural in East Africa. And even in peri-urban areas, they estimate Nairobi, it'll be over 50% of people living in this kind of a space. Right, because people are just looking for opportunities. So it's just meeting people where they are. And so for peri-urban areas, we found a big aggregation point, right? A big activity was essentially going to buy small things every day across almost all categories. It's just 20% that goes through the formal channels. Right, so the big supermarkets, where I go to shop. 80% is in really tiny shops like these, and the people they're serving.
80% are coming through these small shops. So
the informal trade.
So Unilever, P&G, all of these people, right? They're selling at a wholesale to all of these tiny operators, and they have zero idea where 80% of their product ends up.
And that's almost
consistent. Other than just this sort of general. Yeah.
It is a stunning statistic, and it's almost consistent across most of Africa. South Africa is kind of a unique case. They're probably about 60% formal retail. Everywhere else, it's, you know, 10, 20% formal retail. It is amazing to me.
Yeah. Let me make sure I have this right. 50% of the population of a city like Nairobi, which is typical, is estimated to live in these smaller ex-urban enclaves that are less developed. And 80% of the commerce is informal in these developments.
Correct. Yes, exactly. So if you know, part of what I love about my job, again, is it breaks you out of these bubbles, right? My day-to-day in an urban city like Nairobi with 4 or 5 million people, you know, 1.8, 2 million people have a very different day-to-day experience. And it took us to come to partner with Nganga and spend time with some of these traders to understand what that looks like. And those kiosks do more than sell goods. This is the other learning. Those kiosks actually serve as also the leading channel for financial services. So they're often giving credit as well to these end users. So someone comes to the shop, and based on trust and based on relationship, right, they know you're going to be able to pay back tomorrow because, you know, you're a farmer, you're a trader, I know what you're doing, it's fine. I can offer some credit. There's an enormous amount of credit going through that channel as well. FSDK Africa, a partner of ours that do research in this particular area, they found it is the leading channel for credit, right? It's just informal. It's just based on trust.
What you're saying is that all of these small shops, tiny little shops,
yeah,
are extending credit to their customers, but they have no access to credit for themselves.
Exactly. And so the key insights, if I could summarize for you, because we were attracted to these shops, they're talking to lots of people. So they're a great way for us to reach those people. But what we found is, one, they operate informally. It seems simple, but you will see them when we go out. And that means they're not keeping records. That means they have very little insight into how their business is doing. And their business is often intermixed with their personal lives in a very big way. So the cash flows that they get could be used to pay school fees immediately, pay for a hospital emergency for someone in the family. And that lack of insight, even for themselves, is difficult for them to sort of plan their next stage of growth. At its simplest, the next thing is that they accept cash mostly. And they may have M-Pesa, which is a good insight. They may have a bank account, but they're not using that facility, right, for their business, for various reasons. Cost, just the burden of having to get cash into the facility and out of the facility. And they really generally don't see the value of that facility. This is a core issue. This is how we see financial inclusion. Until that trader sees value in that facility and wants to use it on a day-to-day, uses it, then they get included.
So these are SMEs, but they're almost, you know, as referred to in some of this stuff, it's MSMEs. It's,
yes, like micro, small. Actually, it depends, and I'm glad you raised that. I think we are dealing with micro SMEs, micro retailers, kiosks. And those could range anywhere from roadside sellers, right? People who just have wares and they'll set them up at a particular time, to mostly what you'll see, which is sort of like a 2 by 2 meter space with a grill and it's sort of over the counter, to a really, I guess what you'd call in Brooklyn, like a mini market, like a corner store, really small.
A bodega.
Yeah, but yeah, you could walk in, you could kind of go around, but they still classify as a kiosk, they still classify as underserved, they're still using cash, they're still operating informally. And so that kind of breadth of micro merchants, MSMEs, we estimate are in the order of, you know, there's over a million of them in East Africa, right? There's over a million of them. And these guys are not growing, and they're underserved financially, right? And so we see success as these guys getting access to relevant financial services, right? So part of our job is also working with financial service providers like Musoni and DTB, some of the other folks, and getting them to shift their mindset, right? Those are, they might on the surface believe that they're potential customers, but in terms of how they build their business, it's difficult for them. So we help them, we bring them to the field, we co-create with them, we get them to understand these people can be trusted. This is our end goal, and they can be trusted because you know their location, right? You know what they're buying, you know who they're lending to, and you know their aspirations, essentially. And if you know those things, then you can start to, you know, reconfigure your product offering for them.
Well, it's also sort of reassessing traditional credit models.
Exactly.
I mean, beyond giving them a transactional history, you're reassessing the credit model to bring back into the element of personal trust.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that trust is... So we ran a workshop. In the very early days when we were trying to figure out what problem we want to solve. And so we spent obviously time with traders in their shops, but we also tried to bring them together, right? Because we felt there'd be their communities, and it was a good idea. Because, and it was here in Kawangware, we brought along a few bankers as well, and we kind of just let them talk to each other to kind of understand the dynamic, and it was a trust issue. It was a big trust issue on both sides.
Yesterday they said that the smartphone adoption rate was at about 15% right now, and that it would be at about 50% in 2020. Is that accurate?
Those stats, so as a guy who works in research, I can tell you it is really painful gathering reliable data here. It's really difficult. What I have read is more on the trend line than on the actuals. And so the trend line looks like over 50% of shipments of mobile phones in several countries by 2018 will have exceeded 50%. So Kenya is one of those countries. The handset cost has gone down enough that the shipments can increase, but then adoption is also impacted by the cost of data, right? So I could have a smartphone, but I'm using it like a dumb phone because I can't afford a data bundle. so those costs have to come down, be more accessible as well. And then there's an aspect of value as well. So most people adopt, smartphones for killer use cases, for reasons, right? Not just because they're smartphones, either because they can do things on social media. That's typically the killer use case for getting a smartphone. A nicer camera. But see, our job is fun because we need to think, how do we take those two insights and apply them to here? How can a camera be meaningful to a micro retailer on his day to day, right? How can messaging be meaningful? We're starting to do that with SMS. And then how can we find new ways for that cost of data to be more sustainable for that trader? We haven't cracked that yet. That's a difficult one. So in the initial days of Kionic, we built both smartphone and smartphone app and just feature phone app. And we loved the smartphone app. Everyone was like, why isn't it? It's cost of data. Yeah, their margins they make are so small, and they have so many competing interests for their income, be that buying more product, which is the immediate need, be that school fees for their kids, be that healthcare. Healthcare is a huge need in these areas, back to the infrastructure issue, and the fact that people don't really seek care soon enough because they're dealing with all of these other things. So data is it's a luxury. It's a nice to have. And it's bought in bundles. It's bought up front.
What do you think that infrastructure-wise would have to happen to make data plans less necessary? Is that a solution in any way?
That's a great question. So we're currently in the process of thinking about a new theme called digital financial service infrastructure. Interesting. So we've looked at agriculture, looked at micro retail supply chain, which is what we're doing now, looked at education, and we're looking at infrastructure now. And that is a very big thing. So you can think of infrastructure in terms of hard infrastructure, so a physical space in the rails for things to move. That's typically, the towers. And then you can think of it in terms of like network coverage as well. And so when we think internet access, like the smartphones, we're typically thinking 3G, 4G, but increasingly we're seeing new players come into this space to challenge that, to challenge how last mile access to internet is sort of provided. And those are the, when I say big players, I mean the Googles, the Facebooks, the there's a lot of new brand internet service providers that are doing things in interesting ways. They are going to rural areas, peri-urban areas, and thinking about how to do things around TV white space, so a new spectrum, or a spectrum that has existed for a long time but has not been used. So how can we use that channel, it's a radio channel, to deliver internet at really low cost? There's a lot of pilots in Kenya going on right now that are challenging that 3G, 4G model, and that's interesting. We are paying very close attention to that because it's just essentially Wi-Fi. It could be a really, really great way. Wi-Fi and mesh networks. So internet connectivity is a big part of what we're doing and how we scale it. And cost is something we're constantly thinking about. The other way to think about cost as well and infrastructure is, you know, if the trader cannot pay for the data bundle, how else can you subsidize? How else can you subsidize that? There are other stakeholders perhaps who would be interested in this micro trader getting access.
What is it about Kenya in particular that seems to be so rich an environment to try these pilot programs? There's a lot of places you could experiment or pilot. So what do you think it is about Kenya specifically that seems to foster the ability to pilot these kinds of innovations?
That's interesting. I think it's been a journey. I don't think it just happened. I think as a starting point, a distinguishing factor is it's a fairly high literacy rate for the country, just based on I guess the history of the country and its investments in education. That's one. The second is the youth kind of bulge. So in the order of 60 to 70% of the population is under 35. And that youth bulge means there are a lot of young people who are fairly well educated. And then the next piece is they have access to mobile. So mobile and internet access more than other countries, driven by the fiber optic cables starting to land in, let's say, 2011. We had a very progressive permanent secretary of ICT in the day who made it his mission to ensure that barrier, right, to fairly fast internet access was broken.
So these MSMEs are the economic backbone to their communities. They are the major source of employment and the major source of credit for goods and services. And the product that the lab designed, the MSME business solution, is called Kianect, and it works on a smartphone or a feature phone. A kiosk owner needs to restock. Instead of taking time away from the kiosk to go to the wholesaler, waiting for the products, hauling them back to the store, and setting them up, the store owner uses their Kianect code, sends an order to the wholesaler through their phone, the wholesaler creates a digital order form, sends back the total, the store owner confirms it on their phone, then a sales rep, who is actually a motorcycle delivery man, brings the product. He has the order on his smartphone. The store owner uses their code to confirm the delivery and payment because the code is connected to their mobile money account, either M-Pesa or another mobile money account. This creates a digital record for all of the items being bought for the store and for the wholesaler. So for the product to work, both the kiosk owner and the wholesaler need to be on Kianect. So the wholesaler that they worked with is Nyango Wanjohi.
Nyango Wanjohi?
Yeah, I'm going to let him say it. I asked him how he came to work with the lab.
We're in the market looking for a cashless solution. So I think somebody heard that we were, and they came knocking one day on my door. So it was just the right time.
So what inspired you to look for a cashless solution?
One of the biggest challenges, because when you're setting up the business, you walk through processes and everything. One of the biggest challenges was, at one point, if the shop is holding a certain amount of cash, who goes and banks it? And it becomes operational. So every day at 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock, someone leaves to go and bank. what you're doing is you're exposing your stuff. I needed to find a way not to bring hard cash back. So it was actually for me to begin my day one, had to be cashless. And until I got a solution, I was not going to open.
So what was the process of working together? Like, what were the questions they asked you to figure out the beginnings of this?
I think how it began was I told them what I saw as the solution. Mm-hmm. So I walked them through and said, this is what I think can work. This is what I think the trader would need. Are we able to build something like this? Mm-hmm. So we came up with a prototype. Then we called traders in and sat to them and said, this is what we have. Are you comfortable with it? Someone said, no, some of this I don't want. So we had to keep on changing stuff.
So the solution you saw is the solution they have now?
The solution that we have now is the first version. I keep calling it version one. There's going to be more developments. But what we have right now was because we needed to go to the market, we needed to test the concept, we needed to make sure that it works. We needed people to also get comfortable with it before we started introducing more value-added benefits to it. So yes, this was what we both agreed with as our first step for the pilot, for the project to begin.
So you're the host wholesaler.
Yes.
How did you get your retailers or the people buying from you comfortable with this?
The acceptance of the application was built on trust.
Okay.
Many of the traders, it's the exposure to applications really was, if it was an application that was going to be relevant to the business, would have downloaded it. But what we needed to do is that we needed to first create a relationship between ourselves and our traders as a platform to introduce the application to them. So it really was, the first step was, who are you? Then we created a relationship, and then this is what you have. Because after this, we're going to take many other things to them.
Now, as you can tell, Nyango was completely vital to the creation of Kianect. And the next step was to make the digital record available to the financial institutions and get the kiosk owners the credit that they extended to their neighbors and that would allow them to build. So MasterCard worked with KCB Bank, which was the biggest bank in the region, and Unilever to develop a system that would allow them to start accessing and using credit immediately. Dilip Harry, the Vice President of Enterprise Partnerships, explains how it works.
So let me try to explain a bit of the solution, how it actually works, what we've built with Unilever. So if you imagine a Unilever sales rep comes to these small stores once a week. Every week they go on the same route to the same store. They go with a handheld tool to take an order. And the next day, a delivery truck comes and delivers the goods for cash. That's the current model. Now, what we have created together with Unilever is that nothing changes really for the store, except for when the van comes, you don't have to pay the van in cash. You pay later to KCB. So that's our proposition. So there's no digital change at that point for the store. All they need to have is a mobile phone. Because of the mobile phone, they get a text message in the evening saying, you have been charged 1,000 shillings for your order today. You've got, and we've created at the moment, an interest-free period of up to 17 days. So you've got at least 7 days of interest-free credit to pay back for your goods. It's depending on what day of the month you order. There are different repayment mechanisms. So there is the digital wallet that you can use, but you can also go and pay into a KCB branch, into a KCB agent. So it's interest-free for the stores for up to 17 days. After that, interest is being charged at a very competitive rate, actually. Maybe it's too competitive because we see people are using it. And the behavior that we do like to encourage is that, you pay back before the next visit of your sales rep.
Unilever agreed to be the corporate partner to test this, partially because, as George said, once the product is delivered to the wholesalers, they don't really know how it's distributed or how fast it moves. So Bruno Witwet, the Executive Vice President Africa at Unilever. Explain to us why he felt like it was important for Unilever to be involved.
We touch around 2.5 billion consumers every day in the world. That's the size of Unilever at the moment. And Africa is very big in terms of the number of people we touch. Actually, the heart of our business in the overwhelming majority of countries in Africa remains with what we call traditional trades, which is here is Dukas. You know, they have different names depending on the countries, you know. And what is important, we talk about a store, but what we see is behind any store, there's one or two families, actually. So it's about the people. So behind a store, we see two things. We see a business opportunity for us, because we're in business, let's be very frank, like all of you guys. But also we see family, we see livelihoods, and we see livelihoods in the context of the community. Because these people normally, they come from the community where they live. They don't come from another side of the city to operate. So that's very important. And the main issue these people have in Africa, this is a strange thing, borrowing money is extremely expensive, far more than the inflation rate of the country, and that's the case in Africa. So what can we do if we want to develop our business? And our business is very simple, access to more consumers. So access to more consumers is more points of distribution for your products, and you name it. And that's why Duka is at the heart of the model in Kenya.
And then finally, KCB's Dennis Ngoe, he expounded on KCB's role.
It's both a challenge and an opportunity at the same time. Now, let me just be a little bit more context. So if you look at the Duka guy that Bruno just talked about, when I was growing up, we had a Duka somewhere close to where I am. And of course, that's where we lived. And a lot of times we would actually still look for credit as customers from the same Duka. And they would have this book where they fill up our credit for the whole month. And therefore, when mom is paid at the end of the month, she comes and pays it up, and then they can cancel my page and probably open another. And sometimes they definitely do have the challenge of the fact that they have to fund their working capital. And they also have to fund their customers to buy from them. And that creates a bit of a limitation in terms of what it is that they can do. But from a KCB perspective, we see this as a huge opportunity, because one of the biggest challenges has been the fact that then they have ran out of a digital system. And therefore, we are not quite able to see what exactly it is that they have done. And that's basically the point that Bruno makes. From a cash perspective, then we lose sight of that conversation. And that's why, again, to Bruno's point, I think this partnership is extremely important, because one of the things that we seek to do is actually digitize this whole ecosystem and be able to say, as a bank, if we could see a bit more of what it is that you're doing, then we could understand you a whole lot better. And if we can understand you a whole lot better, then we can actually then come through in terms of our support in a much, much, much bigger way, which is basically what we're looking at. So, yes, it is a challenge, but in our view, it is also an opportunity that we seek to then capitalize on, so that then ultimately, if they can also grow, and it seems to be a lot of sometimes what Bruno says, they see their growth in the growth of these value chains. And so do we. If then those outlets then get to grow, then we see ourselves as well growing. And if you look at even how just you progress some of these customers. So you made a point earlier and talked about the MSMEs as a big opportunity, particularly in this continent. And if you look at it, then you'll probably see some of them growing from being the micro merchants to becoming small merchants, to becoming medium and merchants. And we move that ladder all the way. So part of even our growth in terms of our SMEs, in terms of our corporates, is actually to be able to grow the guys who are at the bottom of the pyramid and then bring them all the way, which is basically the huge opportunity that we are excited to pursue in this partnership.
So KeyConnect allows for the bank to see what is actually happening at the MSMEs to better understand them and begin to offer services that help them grow. It offers the large producers like Unilever data about where their products go, what is truly popular, and a growth of place in the market. It offers MasterCard an opportunity to be the early builder of corporate relationships and a place to build and test products with innovation lessons and an innovative spirit that can spread throughout their company. And it offers the wholesalers on the ground a safer, cashless, documented delivery and payment system. It offers the kiosk owners the chance to be entrepreneurs, to grow their business, which means to grow their family. In Kawangware, I met a kiosk owner, Edie. And Edie runs a small kiosk among many kiosks. We were there
And please excuse all the background noise. A few minutes after we pulled up, we were swarmed by curious children all around wondering what we were doing there. And when they saw the mic, they just got more excited. But despite that, I want you to hear Edie.
So I just asked when she started the business. She said she started 7 years ago, and she started it just to help her family, just for extra income for the family.
Two kids.
She has two children.
One is at home.
One in total. Mukuba. Yeah. Okay. So she has two kids, when one of them is at home.
And this one is really.
Who are you, Nani?
It's a
nephew. Yeah. Kuna tunaweza kutumia aje? Kazi unaitisha order na simu ama SMS?
Naitumia. Naitisha na zaitisha order ama SMS.
SMS. So I just asked her how she uses Qnet. So she says she places orders with the SMS. Imekusaidia?
Inanisaidia.
And she says the system helps her. Just helps her.
How?
Imekusaidia aje?
Inanisaidia ju karibu siwezi enda mbali.
Inakaa kwa duka.
Inakaa tu. Inanikujia.
So it helps her because she doesn't have to leave the shop. She can just place the order and then the goods will come to her.
How much time would it save?
Did you have to save? Come on, take a gap.
For almost half an hour.
Okay, half an hour to an hour. Sometimes you leave somebody in the shop if she has to go collect items. And actually, that's her niece. What is the name again?
Juliet.
That's her niece. So sometimes she's also at the shop.
So do you work in the shop too, Juliet?
Sometimes.
Thanks. Only when you want to?
No, when I'm available.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So what do you do when you're not working at the shop?
When I'm not working, I've been in school, but I just finished. I've been doing some consultancy work.
Nice. What kind of consultancy?
Climate change.
What kind?
Climate change.
Oh, fascinating.
Yeah.
Very cool. So were you helped by the fact that is this your aunt?
Yep.
Were you helped by the fact that she had this shop?
Sorry?
Were you helped by the fact that she had this shop?
Yep.
Yeah? Did it help your education?
Yeah, she could send me some pocket money, you know, some credit cards. Yeah.
So it basically enabled you to do what you're doing now.
I can count on
her. She says she can count on her.
From sustaining our immediate family, also she's able to sustain our extended family, you know, from this. It looks small, or you never know the impact of this yet.
It did look small. It was a tiny shop, chock full of goods to sell, busy with activity among rows of tiny, well-kept shops. And it helped pay for her son's educations and her niece Juliet's education. And another nephew was at her feet to be the next one. And it was something they all relied on. Edie is someone they count on. And that is the real benefit in the end. Helping an MSME grow is like planting 5 trees for every tree you pull up. It grows and makes cities greener and happier. It brings jobs and opportunity like rain. MasterCard's Qnet helps feed the root system. And in the end, that tiny shop is just a tiny seed. They'll grow into a forest of hope for a family, for a business, for a community, and for a country. From Nairobi, Kenya, this is Rachel Morrissey for Breaking Banks.
Well, thank you all for joining us on Breaking Banks this week. I'll be back next week leading the fintech newspapers with our hosts. We'll be talking about some new topic in the fintech space. Now, don't forget, we're a member of Provoke.fm. We produce podcasts all about finance and tech. You can go to provoke.fm. You can find FinTech 5, Serial Entrepreneur, JP Nichols podcast, Breaking Banks Asia with Simon Spencer, and other shows that you first heard here on Breaking Banks. You can find this show and discuss the episode on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. You can be a part of the conversation. Tell us about what you like. Tell us about what you'd like to hear more about. If there's startups you've heard of that are interesting, have got an interesting story, or banks who are progressing with their digital transformation, have done some amazing things, let us know so we can cover it on Breaking Banks. Now, we have over 200 episodes covering everything in the fintech space, so make sure you go to breakingbanks.com to check out our backlog of episodes, and make sure you subscribe and leave us some rating on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever it is you download the podcast. Thanks again for joining Breaking Banks. Have a great week, which was what's left of it, and a great weekend, and I'll have a new show for you next Thursday. Thanks again.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.